You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, beer, cheese, and bread are big parts of our diets, and it turns out they're a big part of human evolution, too. We'll learn more in just a bit. Now, House Speaker Paul Ryan announced last week that he is not seeking re-election for his seat in Congress this year. Ryan said he wanted to spend time with his family and stop being a weekend dad. His impending retirement is the latest and one of the highest profile departures among Republican lawmakers in the House. Ryan has held the seat in Wisconsin's 1st congressional district for nearly two decades. He's been a rising star the whole way up to his rise to House Speaker. His retirement leaves that seat and the race wide open for political hopefuls, such as Democrat Randy Bryce and state Republicans. Harry Enten is a senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics. Harry, welcome back to Central Time.
I'm back.
It's been
Thank
a while.
Thank you for having me back. It's been a while.
Same title, new place. Congratulations on that.
Thank you, sir.
Well, you wrote a whole piece about our little congressional district here in Wisconsin, Harry. What are you watching for in the numbers in that race?
I mean, look, this is a seat, Paul Ryan's seat, that although Donald Trump won it by, you know, about 10 percentage points, maybe a little greater than that, or right around there, you know, this is a seat given the national environment that could easily be won by a Democrat. And we know from the data that we've seen so far in the special elections that really would not be a big surprise. And Randy Bryce, who we'll get into, the leading Democratic candidate, has raised a lot of money, and there's no real Republican candidate right now that's running that to me looks like a very strong candidate. So it could definitely be the case that Democrats take over Paul Ryan's seat come November.
Let's talk about that national climate, Harry. I know you're obsessed with this thing called the generic ballot. Talk about that and what we're seeing.
Yeah, so basically the generic ballot is a question that's put on national surveys, which essentially asks, in the fall, will you vote for the Democratic or Republican candidate in your district? It does not subscribe names to that particular ballot question, but we know from the past that it's pretty telling of what will occur in the fall, even at this particular time. And the long-term average has had Democrats up by about 8 percentage points. And given where Wisconsin's one is on the political spectrum, that would put that district very much in play given the generic congressional ballot. And if there's a strong candidate on, say, the Democratic side versus a weak one on the Republican side, the generic ballot clearly indicates that the Democrats could, in fact, take the district.
And on the other hand, if there were a big, well-funded national figure on the ballot, like, say, a Paul Ryan, that might skew that generic ballot into a non-generic Republican direction, say.
Correct. We know from the past that incumbents tend to outperform the generic ballot in their district, even in, say, wave elections, which this election could be, although, you know, obviously we're still a number of months away. So if Paul Ryan were on the ballot, I think that most people would agree, most analysts who are being true to themselves would say that he was going to win re-election, probably by a decent chunk, even if, let's say, less than last time around. But without him on the ballot, all bets are off.
Let's look at that Republican side of the ballot. One of the biggest names people have talked about was Reince Priebus. He says he's not running. Some of the state lawmakers, the state's assembly speaker, not running. How important is it to have a name that people know at this stage in an election?
I mean, look, you're still a few months or month and a half from, say, the when people can actually put their names on the ballot, you know, put the forms in. So it's not at this particular time that important, but Republicans better get their act together fairly quickly because the candidates who are right now running are not people who I would describe as strong. And in fact, one of them, Paul Nyland, is pretty much, you know, a sitting duck for the general election for reasons that we could get into if we want to. So, yeah, it's important that they get someone on the ballot that's good, because if they don't, forget it. Given how much money Randy Bryce has raised, it could be a long haul for Republicans come November.
Talking to Harry Enten from CNN Politics about Wisconsin's 1st congressional district, the one currently held by House Speaker Paul Ryan. He is not running again. Let's talk about the Democratic side. Kathy Myers running on the Democratic ballot, and you mentioned Randy Bryce, who's gotten a lot of national attention, not conventional candidates in some ways, an iron worker and a teacher here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing we should keep in mind, right? We still have a primary, so, you know, a lot of the national attention has, in fact, been on Bryce. But Kathy Myers, who's obviously been, you know, a member of the board of a local school board in Wisconsin, could, in fact, win the nomination, although she's raised so much less money than Bryce has, who's raised over $4 million, which would be a strong haul by pretty much any candidate especially in one state like Wisconsin, where, say, the media markets are not as expensive as, say, they are in New York State. So, you know, these are the Democrats have a pretty decent field that's been lining up, a field that was lining up perhaps to take on Paul Ryan. And let me tell you this much. Democrats nationally are looking for blood. Donors are looking for blood in the water. And so the idea of them taking the district that belonged to Paul Ryan is very, very, let's just say, susceptible. Democrats really might be just throw all money into this race as possible in order to take it.
And there's been a long line, getting back to the national level now, Harry, of Republican House representatives saying, nope, not running again this year, either stepping down right away. There was just another announcement today of somebody bumping up his schedule to leave the House. Where are we now? How many candidates are out roughly, and what is that telling us?
Yeah, so Charlie Dent today, who's a representative, a moderate rep from Pennsylvania, who had already announced that he was going to retire, is now saying that he's going to resign in a few weeks. And in fact, there have been about 40 retirements, resignations, people who are running for higher office on the Republican side. And, you know, it's not exactly clear looking in the past that retirements on the whole necessarily tell us very much, you know, in terms of pure numbers. But what we do know, as I mentioned earlier, is when incumbents do not run, those seats are far more susceptible to being won by the other side, because there is still an incumbency advantage in this country whereby incumbents run stronger than people, say, who are not incumbents. And so the idea that there are this many Republicans retiring is very welcome news for Democrats, because it makes winning those districts far easier.
You wrote another piece on kind of the spread, the range of likely outcomes in the race for the House this fall. Can you talk through the most likely and then the extreme cases?
Yeah, so I think that the most likely outcome, based upon all the measurements that we're looking at, is that Democrats are going to take control. They need to net 23 seats at this particular time. And I think anywhere between, say, 20 and 40 net gain for the Democrats is most likely, with probably, say, 30 to 40 is more likely than 20 to 30. But as you hinted at, there's a wide margin of error with that, especially at this particular time. Look, campaigns happen, campaigns take place, and things can change. So it wouldn't surprise me if, say, Democrats only won, say, 10 to 15 seats, but we also shouldn't be that shocked if they win, say, 45 to 50 seats. All of these scenarios on the table, but the most likely outcome is that Democrats are going to gain control by picking up, say, 20 to 40 seats when they need to pick up a net gain of 23 seats in order to take control of the House of Representatives.
And Harry, right now you're in Roomba mode, going around trying to get little bits and crumbs of data off the floor. What are some of the next signs you're looking for?
I think the big next sign is in Arizona. Next week there's a special election in Arizona's 8th congressional district. This is a very Republican-leaning district. Donald Trump won it, you know, by about 20 percentage points. And if the Democrats come close there, and there are some signs that they will, though I still think that the Republican candidate, Debbie Lesko, is favored, if Democrats come close there, it's yet another sign in another Republican-leaning district that no candidate on the Republican side can take anything for granted, and that the national environment has clearly shifted from 2016.
We've talked about the House this whole time, Harry. Talk about what's up in the Senate now. It's a tougher field for Democrats.
It's a far tougher field for Democrats, because pretty much all of the seats that are up, remember, one-third of the Senate gets up every 2 years, pretty much all of the seats that are up are Democrats. I believe it's, what, eight that are Republicans or something along those lines. It kind of changes as people have been stepping down. And so Democrats need a net gain of two, and it's pretty clear where they could get those two, Nevada and Arizona. But then the big problem is, because Democrats control so many seats, and in many in red states, say West Virginia, Missouri, Indiana, Montana, among North Dakota, among others, they have to defend all of those as well. And that's a tough and a long road to haul. So Republicans are favored to maintain control in the Senate. They may even pick up a seat or two, though Democrats could pick up some seats and take control. But that is no indication of the national environment. That's far more an indication that Democrats just got unlucky with the seats that are up this cycle.
And are you watching the Wisconsin Senate race?
I'm always watching everything in Wisconsin. Yes, I'm watching Tammy Baldwin's race. I mean, the polling there does indicate that Baldwin is probably a favorite. You know, Wisconsin, though it was won by Donald Trump, was won by less than a percentage point. And so it would take a shift in the national environment for Baldwin to really be in trouble. But, you know, shifts sometimes happen. So we'll be keeping an eye on it.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Harry Enten, senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics. He joined us to talk about the race for Congress and how the election could shape up in Speaker Paul Ryan's home district, the first district here in Wisconsin. Now, Wisconsin is known for a lot of things. Big on that list, beer and cheese. Both of these foods have been huge culinary staples in the state, so much so that our professional baseball team is named after one of them, and pro football fans wear the other one on their heads. But while beer and cheese make up the fabric of Wisconsin's food culture, they also served a crucial role in the diets of our ancestors, along with wheat, and these foods in particular may have played a big role in the evolution of modern humans. John Hawks is a paleoanthropologist. He's the Vilas Borghese Distinguished Achievement Professor in the Department of Anthropology at UW-Madison. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Well, I tend to think of evolution as a really, really long-term thing, so it's kind of hard to wrap my head around the idea that, you know, particular foods may show up recently on the evolutionary record, but they do, it turns out.
Yeah, I mean, Darwin conceived of evolution as something that was really gradual and took a long time, but we've been more than 10,000 years since the invention of agriculture, and we've started eating these domesticated foods, and that's plenty of time for our bodies to have exhibited some changes in response to them.
10,000 years feels like a long time for a human lifespan. It feels really short compared to the age of the Earth. We can start to see significant differences in that short span of 10,000 years?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, our species has undergone some really rapid changes in some populations, and other populations sort of still look like the ancestral state in those big changes.
Let's get into some of the foods that have made a difference. Wheat, key to a lot of the foods we eat, junk food and healthy food too. When did we first start eating cultivated wheat?
Wheat was one of the earliest domesticates in the Near East. Started around 10,000 years ago, and in fact, people were deliberately planting wheat even earlier than that, as early as 18,000 years ago. So they've been living with wheat for a long time. Wheat is one of the really puzzling foods for us as anthropologists because we rely on it. We depend on it a lot. We do have some changes in our starch metabolism that probably do have something to do with wheat and bread and those sorts of foods. But wheat is something that has a dark side in a lot of people, and it's because of gluten. Gluten insensitivity and celiac disease is a major health problem today, and it's something that actually has a puzzling effect in our evolutionary history because it's a weird case in which a lot of people are literally allergic, have a reaction to a staple food.
Yeah, why does that happen? This food that so many people rely on, you'd think evolutionarily, you wouldn't want that kind of reaction.
That's exactly right. You know, evolution is supposed to make us well-suited to our environment. And our environment today is one that has these foods in it. So why is that a problem for us? It turns out one of my PhD students and I studied this several years ago, and the alleles, the gene variants that make you susceptible to celiac disease, are things that actually have great importance in immunity. And celiac disease today is like an overreaction or a misreaction of our immune system to a common protein in our diet, gluten. So we didn't evolve to be celiac because of wheat. Celiac is a side effect that our immune systems have in the presence of wheat.
This happens a lot with evolution, right? It's kind of cobbling with what's on hand. So we've got a structure that started off meant to crawl around on all fours. We were upright, and that's great, but we get lower back problems because it wasn't really originally designed that way.
That's exactly right. You know, in anthropology, we call this concept the scars of evolution. You know, we have these things that are not so great about us. You know, our lower backs are not so great at standing up for long, you know, throughout our lives, and that's because we evolved from quadrupeds. You know, our feet are not so great at doing what they do, and because we haven't been bipedal forever and ever. And celiac is one example of this.
It's interesting to think of things like, getting back to the food side of things, like mm-hmm. the paleo diet, the foods that humans evolved to eat in nature. But as we've cultivated foods and domesticated foods, we've been evolving along with them.
Yeah, probably the clearest example of how we've really changed a lot in response to food is lactase. Milk has lactose as a sugar in it. All kinds of mammals can digest that sugar when they're babies because that's what milk is for. It's for feeding babies, right? It's really weird that some human populations have been keeping dairy animals for thousands of years. You know, milk from cattle and from goats and from sheep. But over the over the centuries in those populations, new mutations arose that allowed adults to digest the lactose in milk. And so those mutations had a huge advantage in those populations and actually began to grow really rapidly in numbers over time. Today's populations of Northern Europe and large parts of Western Asia, and also in some populations in Africa, have separate mutations that let adults in those populations digest milk. And people who don't have a copy of that mutation, we call them lactose intolerant. That's actually the normal state. That's what we all used to be.
Yeah, and so before that, before adults started developing lactose tolerance, if you wanted to rely on some kind of dairy animal, you had to process it with cheese, which isn't such a bad thing, or yogurt. But there's a cost to that, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, bacteria will be happy to digest that lactose for you and take it right out of your diet. And so cheeses and yogurts and fermented milk, you know, the kumis that they drink in Central Asia, those are all strategies to use milk as a food resource, but not have so much of the lactose sugar in it that causes digestive problems. But when you do that, the bacteria is getting the benefit of that energy and you're not. And so in ancient people who had that mutation that let them digest the lactose effectively, they got a caloric bonus. You know, it's up to 30% more calories from the milk. And that probably made a huge difference to them in their in raising kids.
Talking to John Hawks, paleoanthropologist at UW-Madison, talking about the foods we eat today and how they shaped modern humans over the course of evolution. Are we still evolving in reaction to the food we're eating?
You know, lactose has in particular, even in recent, you know, centuries, been going up a little bit in Western populations. So there is a little bit of evolutionary change. Today, you know, you look at all the genetic landscape of our diets and our evolution, and you're looking at things as varied as proteins involved in lipid metabolism that actually some humans have inherited from Neanderthals versions of those, and we don't know exactly how they function, to proteins involved in starch and in glucose metabolism, things that become important in type 2 diabetes. These are all genetics that we're still working to understand. In recent years, how much you eat is probably not a major influence on whether you survive, but it can become a major influence on your health later in life. And so when we look at these genetic variations today and try to understand them in metabolic syndrome and diabetes, we're looking actually at the echoes of those past populations and how they adapted to ancient diets.
I want to move on to one other type of food, or I guess beverage in this case, alcohol. And it turns out different populations around the world have some different genetics when it comes to alcohol absorption.
Yeah, it's interesting because primates are all fruit eaters. And one of the things with fruits is that, you know, they're ripe when they actually start to change some of that sugar into alcohol. You see it on grapes, the yeast that are on the outside of them. You see it on fallen fruits. And primates are pretty good at digesting alcohol. But some human populations have taken this a step further. We've increased the efficiency with which we digest alcohol. Some populations can metabolize parts of it faster. And digesting alcohol is actually a multi-step process. And so if you accelerate one of those steps, you end up with the product of that step, sometimes more, and it can cause a problem. In lots of people in East Asia, they have a gene variant that causes more of the aldehyde product to build up, and that actually causes a reaction of flushing in their faces. And that can make alcohol consumption a little less pleasant for them and limit consumption. In some European populations, we have changed another step, and that actually causes us to metabolize the alcohol faster and causes people to sort of sometimes have a higher tolerance for alcohol. These are things that in today's terms we take care of to really notice because they influence alcoholism, the risk of becoming an alcoholic, but also your reaction to alcohol and how you actually, you know, live with it in your life.
And then looking back in the archaeological record, or I guess the genetic record too, there's a big switch in East Asia when rice cultivation starts. Is that right? And rice wine becomes available?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, actually, alcohol is part of the ancient cultures of almost all of the early agriculturalists in the world. There's a good number of archaeologists today who think that the reason why we domesticated grain was to make alcohol out of it. And so it's certainly been a big part of human cultures for thousands and thousands of years.
I know one thing you track, in addition to the archaeological side of thing, is genetic testing and what it reveals about our ancestors. Are we starting to learn more about when and how food shaped our evolution?
Yeah, it's really fascinating because today's populations are mixtures of ancient groups. And some of those ancient groups were quite different from each other, but they mixed together in complex ways. And when they mixed during the last few thousand years, it was often because they were coming in from different places and bringing different foodstuffs with them. And so one of the big mixtures that contributed to European ancestors was the mixture of agriculturalists who had come from the Near East with cereal crops like corn, or excuse me, like wheat and barley, and steppe pastoralists who came into Europe probably with their dairy animals. And that interaction must have been a fascinating one. We see evidence of the traces of those early milk products inside of pottery that those people used, and also traces of the alcoholic beverages that they were consuming. So that mix must have been really one of the first culinary events in all of our human history, I would say.
And food, more than ever now, travels across international borders. It'll be interesting for archaeologists in your position 10,000 years from now to look back at how we're changing.
Yeah, of course, you look at today and the favorite foods in different parts of the world are often foodstuffs that never lived where people are now, you know. You look at the spread of potatoes across Northern Europe, which is an American crop, the spread of corn across Southern Asia, another American crop. And of course, in the Americas, you have all of these foodstuffs that came from East Asia, like citrus fruits and bananas. And it's just amazing to see how that has become globalized, but also how it has embedded itself into human cultures everywhere.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely, thanks.
John Hawks is a professor of anthropology at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about how the diet of our ancestors, things like beer, dairy, and wheat, shaped our evolution. Now, former FBI Director James Comey gave his first big interview since President Trump fired him last May. Comey sat down with ABC's George Stephanopoulos on 2020. Since then, he's also been on NPR. Throughout the interview, Comey raised concerns about President Trump and his administration. He went so far as to say that Trump was, quote, morally unfit, end quote, to be the president of the United States. Comey also addressed his actions in the investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails in the run-up to the 2016 election. President Trump has been critical of Comey in tweets in the run-up to today's release of Comey's book. Mike Wagner is an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison and an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. He also blogs at prowagner.me. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, unprecedented is a word that gets thrown around a lot. I usually don't like it. We're kind of there right now. Former FBI director doing interviews in a book critical of the president who fired him.
The list of people who have done that is short, right? This is a very unique thing that's happening, both in terms of him getting fired in the first place and then him writing this book and going on television, as you said in the intro there, calling the president morally unfit to serve. This is new waters we're wading into.
In his book and in interviews about his book, Comey says, this isn't a book about me and President Trump. This is a book about ethical leadership based on my career. President Trump, a big part of that, though, that seems to be the President Trump part and the Hillary Clinton parts. Those are the parts we're going to focus on, probably.
We're going to focus on those parts. Earlier sections of the book are kind of building a case for Comey to talk about these parts. He's, in the first chapter, kind of laying out, here is evidence that I am an ethical law enforcement official. Here's how I approach things in a nonpartisan, methodical way, trying to get at the truth without thinking about the political ramifications thereof. And so when he gets to the parts about Hillary Clinton and having the press conference about new questions about her emails very close to the election, and when we get to the part about dealing with President Trump and the meetings that Comey had with him before the president fired him, he's tried to lay the case that he's an honest broker here and not trying to behave in political ways, trying to get people on both sides to accept the choices that he made. And what's probably, I think, going to happen is that Clinton supporters will be very critical of his arguments about why he had a press conference about the emails, and Trump supporters will be critical of other things he has said in the book and on television lately about the president.
Partisan reaction there. And James Comey has been really making the case that he was doing what he did not for the truth on the one hand, but also to preserve the integrity of the FBI. Is that possible, or is this sort of partisan view of everything going to affect the FBI now, too?
It's certainly possible. And I think, you know, for a wide swath of Americans, increasingly likely that organizations like the FBI will begin to be viewed in more partisan ways. That's happened to the United States Supreme Court. WisConTex has done stories to show how that's happening in Wisconsin state Supreme Court elections, that the voting in counties looks a lot like the presidential voting. And so partisanship is a powerful drug. It invades lots of elements of our lives, and it seems to be invading increasingly numerous elements of our lives in the last several years, and the FBI appears that it's going to be not so different in that regard. And so I think more and more people are going to view the actions that the FBI takes through a partisan lens than other ones that they might use.
This is a unique news story in a lot of ways. What do you see the role of the media as in assessing the claims that Comey is making?
Well, it's a job of the news media to report the verifiable truth. And so they need to press Comey on some of the claims that he makes in terms of the way he characterizes himself and then the behaviors he engaged in. And so one thing that we've seen some folks do, George Stephanopoulos did this in his interview with Comey on ABC, was to say, okay, so you say that you're an apolitical law enforcement official, and yet one of the reasons that Comey gave for having the press conference about Hillary Clinton was Comey's thought that Clinton was going to win, and so we can't have an illegitimate president, or I don't want to start her presidency in this scandal where she gets inaugurated and then we start this surprise investigation. We need to tell the people now. But that's a political calculation. He's deciding to do that because he thought Clinton was going to win. And then in the next breath, he says, but I don't do things because of political considerations. And so that sort of thing, I think people need to push Comey on. They also probably should push him on why he waited to write the book until after he got fired. So if there are things that one believes about a leader's fitness for office, why not say them when you believe them? Why wait?
Talking to Mike Wagner from UW-Madison about James Comey, former FBI director. He's got a book out. He's doing the rounds on interviews right now, getting lots of attention and lots of criticism from President Trump. I want to give a listen to that ABC interview where Comey is asked about Donald Trump's fitness for the office of president. Here's his response.
A person who sees moral equivalence in Charlottesville, who talks about and treats women like they're pieces of meat, who lies constantly about matters big and small and insists the American people believe it, that person's not fit to be president of the United States on moral grounds.
Well, he didn't do it immediately after being fired, but he is very critical here of President Trump. He said elsewhere, not hoping for the president to be impeached. He thinks citizens should be the ones to vote him out ultimately.
Yeah, he does. He said that at least once in the interview with Stephanopoulos and has made statements similar to that in other venues, I think including his book. And so, that's sort of the Jim Comey line on the role of citizenship in a democracy.
Are people paying attention? Is this a story that we in the media are focusing on more than the public at large?
Probably, but there are lots of people who care deeply about politics who are following this book and the interviews about the book pretty closely. Strong supporters of the president and strong opponents of the president care about this stuff because they care deeply about the results of elections. The results of elections are meaningful. They set a policy course for the country that is undeniably important. And so it's appropriate to talk about what the former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation says about the president's fitness for office. It's appropriate to talk about meetings he had with the president. It's appropriate for him to talk about decisions he made when running that law enforcement agency. And so it's not wrong for the news media to want to focus on these things. Just focusing on things that are less related to what it means to live in a democratic republic and more related to getting clicks, say, I'm happy to be critical of the news media. So running the clips about what Comey said about Trump's hair and hand size serves virtually no purpose as far as I can tell. But talking about how Trump makes decisions and whether he can be trusted, those things are important.
Does this end up falling into another Trump versus insert a name here feud?
That is how the president engages in virtually everything where someone disagrees with him. And he's done that with respect to James Comey in terms of what he's saying on Twitter, what his surrogates are saying on television. That this is how the president deals with people who disagree with him, especially powerful people who disagree with him strongly.
We're talking to Mike Wagner right now from UW-Madison, looking at former FBI Director James Comey's book and interviews over the last few days, taking a look at the precedent it sets and what it could mean for President Trump. Mike is an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. He blogs at prowag.me. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you following this? Did you watch the interview? What did you think of it? Did it change your mind about his tenure as FBI chief, his subsequent firing? Do you have the book? Do you have it on order? Are you going to read it? What do you think about what James Comey is saying about the president who fired him? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about former FBI Director James Comey, his upcoming book, his interviews on ABC and NPR and elsewhere, and what his side of the story could mean for voters and the Trump administration. Mike Wagner is with us, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What impact do you think Comey's interview or book will have on President Trump or his administration? What did you take away from what he's had to say? Have your thoughts changed in regards to the former FBI director and his role in the 2016 election? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to our callers now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I guess what troubles me about this whole thing about the FBI is they mentioned that he mentioned, you know, 11 days before the election that they were looking again into the Hillary Clinton emails, but why didn't they mention that they were also, that the FBI was also investigating the Trump campaign? Why mention one and not the other? Either don't mention either or mention both. So that, and I think that's the problem I had. And also scolding Hillary Clinton in front of the, you know, the hearing, that's not really his job. His job is to say, basically, we concluded that there was no criminal activity, but he went on to, you know, to sort of scold her, and they never mentioned the Trump campaign. And I totally disagree with every living president and James Comey that Donald Trump's not fit to serve as president of the United States.
Well, thanks for the call. Some critiques often brought up of James Comey. Comey distinguished between the Clinton and the Trump investigation. The Clinton one had been publicly referred.
Right.
He had announced that it was closed, and when he reopened, he says he thought, well, if I don't announce it's reopened, that's kind of like acting in the other direction. But the Trump one was not publicly known.
That's his argument. He said that when we closed the Clinton investigation and then we learned that, no, we meaning the FBI, when the FBI learned that there were a lot of emails from Hillary Clinton on Anthony Weiner's laptop, he had what he calls a duty to correct. So if, from his point of view, since the public thought the investigation was over, but it wasn't, he felt he needed to do something about it. He said especially because he thought that she was going to win and he didn't think it would be fair to start her presidency under the pall of an investigation that was a surprise. So that's the argument he makes about Clinton. And then, as you say, the argument he makes about Trump is that, well, people didn't know he was being investigated. And at the time we're talking about, he wasn't as much of a target of the investigation as other folks in his campaign.
Right. It was Trump's campaign.
It wasn't
Trump
himself. Right. And so Comey sees a distinction in those modes of his behavior.
And people will argue about those
until the end of time.
Thanks for that call, Willem. Dina is with us next in Lake Geneva. Dina, hi.
Hi. Here's what I want to say to everyone. Stop feeding the beast. Do not watch these interviews. Do not buy these books. The second you take a cent for your story, you lose me. You're not a credible source of information. If he had information about the president, then do the logical, sense, legal manner. But it's all scandal. And I'm not a Trump supporter, but I don't agree when they attack Clinton, Obama, Trump, whomever. Just people need to stop feeding into it.
Dina, thanks for the call. He's selling a book, just generating unneeded scandal.
I mean, that's certainly a way to look at it, right? As your caller said, if he had things to say about the president's fitness for office, he could have said so and not profited from it. He could have not written a book and just said those things. He's chosen to do this under writing a book. It's a free country. You can write a book and try to make money doing that sort of thing. But it certainly will affect how credible he's interpreted to be amongst some people out in the audience, including Dina there.
Dina, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Artis with us in Delafield. Artis, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, nothing that I, you know, the book is available for Amazon Kindle, so I do plan to read it. Nothing he's saying about Trump is a surprise to me or anything that I disagree with. I get tired of the way Trump treats people, his disgusting comments. It's just distressing every day to wake up and just hear other things that he said. I do think he is unfit for office. Now, as far as not impeaching him, well, I guess it's going to depend what comes out of the investigation. But, I mean, you know, if something criminal does come out, then I think it needs to be dealt with.
Artis, thanks for the call. Artis says no surprises for her. And is this going to be another thing where people view it through a partisan lens? If you already thought these things, he confirms it. If you didn't, you reject him.
I think so. And he largely says what you'd expect him to say, which is, I made good decisions. Here's why I made them. And it's also not surprising that someone who got fired by the president has critical things to say about the president.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Peter with us in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. James Comey is really self-serving, and I really don't take him seriously when he says that he doesn't want to be a political force and he didn't want to insert himself politically into politics, because every single opportunity he had to affect politics, he did it. With the whole Hillary Clinton email situation, there's people in the government right now probably doing far worse things with their email that don't get looked at. But just because the Republicans were talking about that nonstop with the email situation, he took a hard look into it when it really was maybe something that the FBI should have looked at for a day or a week and then said, there's nothing here. Hillary Clinton ended up producing her emails anyway. So that whole thing that he claims that he needed to give a press conference, I think is just absurd.
Peter, thanks for the call. And people, we're just about out of time, but people across the political spectrum, Donald Trump has called him a showboater. Mm-hmm. People have talked, like Peter, saying he inserts himself publicly into stories where he didn't necessarily need to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a reasonable critique. I think if you look at the balance of Comey's career, he seems to care deeply about his perception of his duty. And the way he explains the stuff that he does is all described and framed in the way of how he approaches what his duty is. There's a duty to correct if I said the investigation was over. There's a duty not to spread stuff until we have something to say about someone. And so those are wrapped up in his own view of his job, and it's not at all surprising that people are seeing those in a variety of ways.
As we wrap up, Mike, in our warp speed media mm-hmm. climate here, are we going to be talking about James Comey's book in a week or two, or is it going to be bumped by the next big thing?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if something bumped it off. Everything that, you know, I thought would be big is gone. Like Paul Ryan is resigning, and that's out of the news, so it's hard to know, but I suspect in our current cycle and with our current president that things will change rapidly.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Mike Wagner is an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison and an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. He also blogs at prowag.me. He joined us on Central Time today to talk about former FBI Director James Comey's big interview since President Trump fired him last year, his upcoming book, and the impact he could have on the Trump administration. Wisconsin has the lowest compensation rate in the country for private attorneys assigned to represent poor people who have been charged with crimes. Lawmakers have introduced several bills over the last couple decades to raise the rate from $40 an hour, including a bill that failed to pass this last session. But as Danielle Kading reports, a group of attorneys are hoping the Wisconsin Supreme Court will say that the rate is unreasonable in an effort to fix what some are calling a constitutional crisis.
On a Sunday afternoon, attorney Travis Slattery is making the rounds at the Taylor County Jail in Medford.
Yeah, I just called ahead. I'm here to see a couple clients that are here.
It's not his only stop on this trip. The Stevens Point lawyer is driving halfway across the state to meet with several other clients at the Ashland County Jail in far northern Wisconsin. For the last year, Slattery has spent a lot of time on the road. That's why he's driving his wife's red Toyota Prius.
Does 400 miles for less than $20.
While on the road, Slattery takes calls from prosecutors or clients to talk about options for plea deals or serving sentences. He's had as many as 70 open cases in the last year through the state public defender's office, but now he has roughly half that.
And my flat fees that I do for private criminal defense are calculated so that I'm making somewhere around $200 an hour on the average case. So, I mean, I make a lot more money on those cases. When I get those, I prioritize those and take less public defender stuff.
That's a problem for the state public defender's office, which assigns 40% of its caseload to private attorneys like Slattery. He can afford it because he rents office space from another attorney, doesn't have any staff, and stays with family when he takes cases in Ashland. But he's a special case, which is a problem for northern Wisconsin, according to Ashland public defender Mark Perrine.
We just don't have enough attorneys just in our area to cover the cases we need. And I attribute that to a couple of things. One is the rate of pay is too low. It doesn't cover the overhead for most attorneys who have an office. And we just can't get attorneys locally to take our cases.
Perrine says they've sought attorneys from as far away as Madison. Ashland County District Attorney Kelly McKnight says he's seen people wait 2 months or even longer.
They're sitting there on cash bail that they can't post, and they sit in jail, and their case goes nowhere, and they don't have an attorney.
The lack of lawyers willing to take cases can also take an emotional toll on victims and hit county coffers, according to Bayfield County Judge John Anderson.
I've had to intervene and appoint people an attorney at county expense because there just simply isn't the availability of a public defender, and that's something that I've never had to do until the last year or so.
Executive Director David Carroll with the Boston-based Sixth Amendment Center says Wisconsin's rate may mean poor clients aren't getting the effective representation they're guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution.
If you have a financial conflict that you're going to lose more money the more you work on a case, it's going to have a tendency to try to get the lawyer to get the person to plead quicker.
In fact, a 2015 survey of state criminal defense attorneys found they do spend less time with these clients, and about half are taking fewer cases than years past. Attorney John Birdsall with the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers says that's why they're asking the Wisconsin Supreme Court to rule the rate unreasonable, because if they don't...
Circuit courts in the state will come to a grinding halt, and people will be sitting in jail for extended periods of time they already are. And there will be a very, very real constitutional crisis.
Travis Slattery says he's taking fewer cases in northern Wisconsin as time goes on.
Because I'm actually getting enough private clients that I make way more money doing other stuff than I do this.
But for now, it won't be long before he's back on the road to meet with the next client hours away. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.